Just gone 25 minutes to 8 on Tuesday night's Arena. The Lammisters by Declan Burke is a fast-paced, farcical metafiction set in 1920s Hollywood. Nods to Bunyan's A Pilgrim's Progress, Laurence Sterne, Flann O'Brien, Cervantes, and, dear listener, a touch of Jane Austen. Burke's comic romp takes in gangsters and their mods, studio moguls, movie vamps, chorus girls, struggling writers, an Anglo-Irish aristocrat and his aide-de-camp, and they're searching for the perfect round of golf. Declan Burke is with me in studio now. That kind of summarises the very easy plot for us, Declan, doesn't it?
Well, thank you, Sean. You've made it sound much more interesting than it felt when I was writing it. But yeah, that briefly summarises what happens.
Yeah, we'll come back to maybe getting a bit more specific just to keep the listener knowing what we're actually
indeed.
At. And I say dear listener because you keep saying you're addressing dear reader within the book as well, or one of the authors, the narrator of the book does.
The narrator, indeed.
Now, this is an old one, Declan, about teaching by example rather than anything else. You, of course, the startings of this book came from a teaching experience, and having set out the rules for those who were at your course, you then said, aha, don't do what I say, don't do what I do, do what I say.
In a nutshell, that's very close. I have taught some crime writing courses in the Irish Writers' Centre, and this goes back to 3 years ago. I was teaching a one-day course up in Dungannon, and by necessity, you need to kind of charge through all the important elements that go into a crime novel. And I just found myself surrounded by, there was 10 or 12 people there. They're obviously very clever. They were imaginative. They were curious. And you're going through a list of do's and don'ts. And, you know, I just realised I was telling them how to and not how to use their most precious resource, which was their imagination.
You're kind of telling them to behave themselves with their imagination a bit, were you?
Well, absolutely. I mean, that's what you're, you know, and you're obliged to, because they want to write commercial fiction and so forth. Mm. Anyway, there and then I resolved halfway through the day.
While you were actually saying to them, now don't do that and don't do this, don't mix up the genres, choose the style of language and stick to a style of language that suits the period
Absolutely.
You're in. You said all of this to them, and in the back of your head you're thinking, I'm going to write a novel that does the precise opposite of everything that's coming out of my mouth right now.
Exactly the thought that popped into my head in around 20 past 12 that morning. Yeah. And
I'd love to hear from some of the people who were at that course about what they thought was happening in the afternoon. Had you already started writing some of this in the back of your head?
No, absolutely not. It was you know, just a kernel of an idea. And I had no idea of the kind of book I wanted to write. I'd always written crime fiction previous to that, and I've always loved crime fiction. And when you write any kind of genre, you know, the reader expects certain beats have to be hit, certain conventions have to be observed, and that's one of the reasons I love to read crime fiction. So what I wanted to do was write a book that kind of, you know, as you so eloquently put it, you know, broke down all those conventions and reversed them and upended them and so forth. And I suppose I felt I was becoming a little bit stale as a reader. I've always been quite a restless reader. You know, like most readers, you don't want to jump straight into, you know, a second crime fiction after you've just finished one.
Yeah.
And it's always been the same as a writer, even though I've written within the crime fiction genre. I've written different types. So there's private eye stories, spy novels, kind of comedy capers. And I just wanted to try something completely different.
Yeah, and you certainly do that in this book. There's no doubt about that. I suppose to give some sort of framework within which we might be able to hold our discussion, you set it in 1920s Hollywood, in the kind of the jazz age. We've got movie moguls, we've got gangsters in them. Well, let's stick with the movie world for the time being. We're in this kind of high-flung movie world where guys are pitching for pictures and all the rest, you know. And at one level, that's a kind of a hard-boiled scenario to it. But it's the way the people in this world express themselves that I suppose is unusual.
Yeah, I mean, you're totally correct. It's 1923 in Hollywood. Mm. It's the height of the jazz age is a year old at this point. And there's movie moguls, you know, the likes of Louis B. Mayer and these kind of people are swanning around. But they're as likely to quote Shakespeare or Homer as they are, you know, to speak in the hard-boiled jargon of the time. And that, to a large extent, was... I started this book late in 2016, in fact, 3 days after Donald Trump was elected president of the United States. And of course, that came in the wake of Brexit. And what struck me, as struck an awful lot of people, was that was, you know, it might have been good news or bad news to some people. The language and the way language was manipulated, upended, meaning and so forth had been completely thrown out the window. You know, meaning now, words now meant what we decided they meant today, and tomorrow, who knew what they were going to mean. And so to me, that the public discourse particularly had become become a very challenging and trying to decipher it and so forth. And I wanted to write a book that reflected the way that language had been changed and to a certain extent reclaim language for the purpose of comic fiction. So the idea of these hard-boiled characters, as you say, you know, speaking in the flowery tones of an Austen novel or, you know, a Thackeray or a Dickens or something like that, that struck me as incongruous and perhaps relevant to what was going on in the real world.
And you know, if you were going to make a movie pitch, I think if you came into a Hollywood producer at any time, wouldn't have to be 1923, and said, I have this great idea about adapting A Pilgrim's Progress, I think that's probably where the meeting would end.
Yes, indeed. The elevator pitch that would see you thrown off the elevator. Again, I was looking for something that would, as you said, would be highly, highly unlikely to be made.
And it's Ed, the wonderfully named, and they're all wonderfully named, but the wonderfully named Edward Bugs Dooley, who's going to do this adaptation.
Yeah, well, the problem is for poor old Bugs, he has been commissioned to adapt The Pilgrim's Progress, and crucially, The Pilgrim's Progress is out of copyright because there's a writer's strike going on in Hollywood at the time, and Samuel L. Silverstein, who is the movie mogul in charge of Silverstein Studios, he's looking for something that's going to be free. That's the most important thing, and everything else after that is virtually irrelevant to him.
Yeah, but just to give a sense of the language, I'd like to do that if we can. So at the point early on where Bugs is making his pitch, the movie mogul Silverstein responds, "Is our pilgrim's progress sufficiently interrupted by obstacle, unexpected revelation and reversal of fortune as to fill out the full hour of screen time now demanded by the more discerning motion picture devotee?" So you're really putting him into an Austen novel in some ways,
having him
speak like that.
Yes, absolutely. And as I say, hopefully people, it's an incongruous thing and a lot of comedy is based on incongruity. But so it's the setting, that it's Hollywood, it would be recognisably Hollywood. There are, you know, real characters involved. Cecil B. DeMille, for example, has a fleeting appearance, so people will recognise some of the historical people, but in my mind, it's a slightly parallel universe in which we have characters who are very like Cecil B. DeMille and Louis B. Mayer, but who talk, as I say, in ways that may not be the expected style.
And into this particular world then of the gangsters in that world, that's not that incongruous really, you know. There are plenty that would say maybe the two worlds are much closer than we might care to admit. Certainly back in the 1920s, they might have been much closer than would have been admitted. But you bring a character who could be from a P.G. Wodehouse novel, but he could also be in a Boucicault play. It really struck me. Now you might tell me the name of this character, because I would be dear listener, for offend that I might say such words.
Sir Archibald Lestrange Bastard is the gentleman I assume you're referring to.
Yes.
The story actually started with Sir Archie, or Archie as it becomes known, who is a Anglo-Irish aristocrat based in Donegal, and his mother is a lifelong fan of the delightful Miss Austen, and therefore, because he's the heir to a fine family fortune, she believes that he must be in want of a wife. Now, Archie believes that he must be in want, in fact, of a chorus doll or a Hollywood actress. So he decamps from Donegal to Hollywood. And that was the idea, that I needed to send Archie to, because I had set the book in my mind in Donegal. But, you know, the dazzling lights of Hollywood seduced both Archie and myself, and I couldn't get him back out of it. And he meets Vanessa Hopgood, who is the most shimmering star in all of Hollywood. And Vanessa is secretly stepping out with Rusty McGrew, who is the leading bootlegger of the time and so forth. So Archie and his aide-de-camp, as you referred to him, Bartley McGuffin, they end up going on the run, or on the lam, which is where the title The Lammisters comes
from. Here we
go,
dear author, with your Bartley McGuffin. So you're giving us a big hint there. don't expect this character to be vitally important, even though I'm going to make you think he's vitally important.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of sleight of hand going on the whole time. I mean, you know, I think this book was certainly written for me. I read a lot. I write quite a bit. So like a lot of readers, I'm very familiar with the conventions and I'm very, you know, with a lot of plot. So it's, you know, it's written with a nod and a wink to the conventions of the genre and conventions of storytelling and so forth. And the problem with the story, as written by Bugs Dooley, as you referred to, is that Bugs is an aspiring playwright, and he quickly realises that he's bitten off more than he can chew and allows himself to be surrounded by these characters he's created. So the story is effectively told by a nameless narrator who knows virtually everything there is to know about the history of Western literature, except how to write a short, concise sentence.
Yeah, and he's not the only writer involved here. And the temptation is to say, oh, well, the writer, that the narrator here is Declan Burke. That's who the narrator is. But if it is Declan Burke, there's another author, Felicia Fortescue, is one of the names she goes by, isn't it?
That's one of her pseudonyms.
And her other name?
Cordelia de Havilland. Felicia, as we meet her first, she is actually undercover because she is writing an expose of the bootlegging world of Hollywood. And unfortunately, due to his enthusiasm as a fellow author, because Bartley McGuffin is also an aspiring author, he accidentally blows her cover, and we discover that she is, in fact, the best-selling and critically acclaimed author, Cordelia de Havilland.
Of books such as Tuesday Grace is Full of Child. Now, how long have you had that sentence in your mind and thought, I'm going to get that into a novel if it kills me?
I can't remember specifically with that. The titles to the Cordelia's novels, which I had a lot of fun with when I was writing them, they popped into your mind. Sometimes, you know, you would be reading something and you'd see a little possible twist and so forth. That was a lot of fun, you know, and Cordelia herself was a lot of fun.
Well, no, that's why I was surprised when I read out the, you know, and I mentioned some writers in there. By no means have I mentioned all the writers that I could have mentioned as possible stylistic guides at certain points along the way in the novel itself. And you say, oh, you make it sound much more interesting and much more fun than it was to write. I would have thought that it was great fun to write, because you literally did say, I don't care where this story goes. And if there's a problem with it, I'm just going to step in, or one of my potential authors is going to step in and say, ah, no, we won't do that. We'll forget about that. That's a bad idea.
Yeah, you could well have been looking over my shoulder as I was writing. As I say, when I sat down to write the book, I really did want to, be, you know, allow myself to write whatever it was that came out, and not to prejudge what was going to come on the page. I also wanted to kind of create kind of a safe space for the imagination. And I know this is a hardboiled world and so forth, but very little of harm is done to any of the characters. And you mentioned P.G. Wodehouse. I love that world in which no matter what happens, you know that nothing too serious is ever going to go wrong. I did want to create an environment, create a scenario in which, despite the many threats of violence and so forth that do occur, that, you know, it would be this safe space, because I very belatedly came to P.G. Wodehouse and you know, it struck me, as it struck many people, about Jeeves and Wooster and Don Quixote and Sancho Panza and so forth, and I wanted that kind of absurdist, that surreal kind
of Archie and his aide-de-camp has that quality
very much.
At any time that something might be about to happen, one of our narrators will step in and say, reader, I'm not going to explain all of that to you don't want that you don't want that come past your delicate ears. You always refer to the reader, or the narrators always refer to the reader as her.
Well, yes, absolutely. You know, my personal experience of going to various literary conventions and so forth, and readings, and the audience is almost entirely, if not exclusively, composed of women. So, and you know,
it's time to call it as it is.
Well, we are, you know, women, you know, read much more fiction than men tend to read much more non-fiction, we'll say, for example, and biography and so forth. It's a wee bit of a nod and a wink towards that.
Going to continue to break the rules. I thought you might take up on the romantic bodice ripper types of novels and go that style for the next one, or have you plans?
Anything is possible at this point.
All the rules have now been broken.
All the rules have now been
broken. I'd love to talk to Declan Burke, the critic, about this book as well, but he was in with us on a regular basis. But I might spare you that to review your own book. We might get somebody else to
You're
do
very
that
kind.
Instead. Declan Burke speaking to us about his novel, The Lammisters, which is published by No Alibi Press.